Welcome again to another edition of Speakers of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Address, and I greatly appreciate you being with us. With these podcasts, we hope to explore issues that touch us and our families in light of the revolution in longevity that is reshaping our Jewish world and community. And we appreciate your support. You can follow us on listen to previous podcasts by going to our website, jewishsacredaging.com, as well as our Jewish Sacred Aging Facebook page. We are grateful for your continuing support and your donations, which help us further our work. And it is with great pleasure that we welcome to the Seekers of Meaning microphone for today's edition, Rabbi Jonah Pesner, the head, the runner, the executive director of the Religious Action Center, otherwise affectionately known in the Reform movement as the RAC, conveniently located on Massachusetts Avenue in Washington, D.C. Jonah, welcome. Thank you very much for giving us your time. I know you're very, very busy. There's a lot going on, and welcome, welcome. First of all, how are you? How are you feeling? How's your family?
We're doing great. Thank you. It's obviously been challenging, like for everybody else, but we're blessed. We're privileged. We've taken advantage of the quarantine time to deepen our connections to one another and our family configuration, and have even managed to distance with our aging grandparents and spend time with them in a safe and responsible way. So we're doing fine. Thank you for asking. And thank you for having me. I'm really honored.
No, we're honored. Thank you very, very much. And a lot of people are rediscovering certain things. It's one of the unintended consequences of this horror. First of all, let's get to the basics right here, because there may be one or two people who are sort of like in orbit for the last generation or so and may have missed as to exactly what the Religious Action Center is. So real quickly, tell me what it is.
Sure. And you know, it's surprising to me how many people actually don't know our storied history. And of course, you know, Rabbi Richie Address, you're part of that history. You've been a leader of the Reform Jewish movement for so many decades. And just appreciate the way in which you have carved out a rabbinate to pursue justice and the way that you pursue it by making sure that as people age, they age with dignity and Jewish values and community. I learn from you, and I think our whole movement and beyond benefit from your leadership. So thank you for what you do.
Jonah, all right, take Yom Kippur off, Jonah. But
well, it's you know, I have a little bit of time, but not enough.
So what
is the RAC? We affectionately call it the RAC, the Religious Action Center of Reform Judaism, which is the social justice and political advocacy arm of the Reform Jewish movement, located strategically in DuPont Circle on Massachusetts Avenue, as you referenced, Richie, just a minute ago, in our nation's capital. And the origin story of the RAC is quite wonderful. The very incredible and underappreciated great Kivi Kaplan. Can I take a second and kind of tell the story of his gift to the Reform movement?
Please.
So Kivi Kaplan, like many wonderful Jewish kind of descendant of immigrants to this country that came here with nothing, and he worked hard, he started a business, became very successful, and then became a prominent philanthropist, but quite a unique figure in American history, in American Jewish history. When he was young and on his honeymoon with Emily, his beloved new bride at the time, they went on their honeymoon to Florida. And having come from Boston, where he and Emily were living, they had never encountered the Jim Crow South. And they hired a black driver, a taxi driver, who drove them around. And everywhere they went, they kept seeing the same sign over and over again at country clubs and other places: no Jews, no dogs. And Kivi was shocked, and as was Emily, and they turned to the black taxi driver and they said, "Is this common down here?" And the black driver just looked at them and said, "They don't even bother with us." And Kivi understood at that moment, no Jews, no dogs, they don't even bother with us. Injustice to one oppressed minority is an injustice to all oppressed minorities. As Dr. King famously said, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And Kaplan became very involved after that kind of awakening in the NAACP. He was actually, at the time of his retirement in the late 1970s, the last white Jewish president of the NAACP, which historically was a coalition of white Jews and black Christians. He said at the time of his retirement, it was time for the NAACP to be a black-led organization, which it has been. I sit on the board, actually, of the NAACP, in part drawing my seat back to Kivi Kaplan. The other thing that he did, in addition to becoming active in NAA, was to buy an embassy-sized building in DuPont Circle, 5 stories tall, a magnificent facility, and donate it to our Reform Jewish movement. But he had one stipulation. His commitment was that the Reform Jewish movement would play host to the civil rights community, which is why it is that Rabbi Dick Hirsch, who was our founding director, the first call that he made when he got to his offices was to his friend, a dynamic young pastor named Martin. And he said, "Martin, I have good news. You have an office in Washington." And the luminaries of the civil rights movement would meet in our offices. The Leadership Conference for Civil Rights was our first tenant and lived with us for years, which is why the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965 were drafted in the conference room of the Religious Action Center of Reform Judaism. And for nearly 6 decades since then, we have been at the center of every civil rights struggle in American history, whether it's the campaign for LGBTQ equality, marriage equality, and equity and fairness for trans people, or reproductive rights and reproductive choice, full women's equality. The Americans with Disabilities Act was written and developed in part in coalition meetings in our conference room. Religious freedom issues, global human trafficking, world AIDS, the list goes on and on and on in the justice issues that the Reform Jewish movement have played host to coalitions for some of the most important social movements in American history.
So you stand on unbelievably powerful shoulders, Rabbi Hirsch, David Saperstein. And now, Jonah, there's this confluence of events. We're recording this the last week in July, and this will post the first week in August. The country is overwhelmed. There's not only the COVID pandemic, but the increasing pandemic of demonstrations, racial injustice, the post-Floyd murder. It would seem that the work of the RAC has never been more needed, important, present than right now. There's a limited staff. That's the reality of life right now in the Jewish nonprofit world. How are you beginning to deal with this? And is your development of these statewide coalition groups a part of this attempt to broaden the base?
Beautiful. Great question. Thank you so much for that. And thank you for invoking the name of Rabbi Ambassador David Saperstein. It would be impossible to tell the story of our beloved RAC without naming him. Rabbi Hirsch was our founder, but then moved to Israel and became the president of the Israel Movement for Progressive Judaism and built Reform Judaism in Israel, which was an incredible legacy. And Dick is now retired in South Florida. Rabbi Saperstein led the RAC for 40 years, a remarkable Moses-like tenure, and built it from just kind of one rabbi and an administrative assistant into a juggernaut, where we were able to sit in coalitions across Washington and have influence across the country because of the RAC that David built with a staff of 30 that brings thousands of teenagers to Washington every year, college students every summer, mobilizes Reform Jewish leaders from across the country to advocate. And so, we really owe David enormous credit. If he were on this podcast, he would remind us that every major civil rights legislation in American history was passed by bipartisan majorities. The Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act were not only passed by bipartisan majorities, they were signed and reauthorized into law by Republican presidents as well as Democratic presidents. So when you said a moment ago, Rabbi Edris, that we need the RAC more now than ever, partly that's because we're at an unprecedented moment of polarization and hatred by people that are citizens and that are co-residents of the same sacred country. So the RAC's job is not only to advocate for positions and policies reflecting enduring Jewish values, but Rabbi Edris, to lean into Jewish values, which very much in the spirit of the Talmud, respected both sides, Hillel and Shammai, right? Elu ve'elu were words of the living God, these and those. So part of the work of the RAC is to bring our people together, both within the Reform Jewish movement, find commonalities, shared vision, shared commitment, shared values, common ground to create sacred dialogue, and then to reach across lines of difference and create unlikely relationships, to bring together conservatives and liberals, Republicans, Democrats, Muslims, Christians, Jews, Black, White, Asian, whatever, together to make the country better. So part of the urgency of the work right now is actually fostering sacred dialogue within our congregations and then beyond. You asked how we kind of, let me just say a word about what roots our work at the RAC. I spoke about the six decades of our history as if there aren't 3,000 years of sacred prophetic calls in the Jewish tradition for justice. We root ourselves in this notion that we were ourselves slaves in Egypt, and we experienced the bitterness of slavery. And having gone through the trials and tribulations of centuries of slavery, and then the passing through of the plagues and into the sea and out finally to the promised land, the fact that 36 different ways, 36 different times, God commands us, you were strangers in the land of Egypt, you were slaves, and therefore you are to love the stranger. You are to be for the widow, the orphan, the poor, the most vulnerable. It doesn't say tolerate. It doesn't say put up with. It doesn't say coexist. It says love. So part of our work, Rabbi Address, is thinking about how do we engage our Reformed Jewish community to reach outside beyond themselves, to get into relationship with low-income churches on the other side of town, communities of color, immigrant communities, Muslim communities, African-American, Latino communities, Native American peoples, and be in deep, sacred relationship. Come together, learn from one another, and then work on issues of common concern. So we arrive at our advocacy for dreamers, for the families who are separated at the border, for refugees and migrants, not because we have some top-down political agenda set in Washington. We have a 3,000-year-old agenda that grew out of our experience of being refugees and strangers in the land of Egypt. And so when we work with local refugee populations, when we show up at Homestead to help shut it down, which was this terrible detention center that was warehousing, caging children, when we get arrested in the nation's capital, along with our dreamers, some of whom are Jewish, it is not because we have some liberal agenda. It's because we are part of this sacred ancient tradition. And so we work very hard, not only to be in relationship with people who are impacted by injustice, whether that's low-income people suffering from poverty, LGBT people who are seeing their rights rolled back, people with disabilities who are have so many obstacles to full participation, the list goes on and on. We also try and reach out to people with political differences to find common ground. So I just gave a big, long filibuster. I didn't answer everything that you asked about the state projects or COVID or Black Lives Matter, but you know, where do you want me to go next?
Well, just real quickly, could you just, I know this is a new initiative, the statewide groups. I know you've had calls into Florida and other states trying to organize to channel my old days on the URJ staff, regional groupings. How do you see and obviously it's a desire to just broaden the base and the importance of the work on a regional level. How's that going? That just started, correct? These regional statewide groups?
Well, we launched what was called Reform California, now is called RAC California, actually about 8 years ago. So there we really tested the notion that even as there was gridlock and polarization in Washington, number one, could we make major significant change on a state level where there's much more ability to experiment and compromise, and where the Reform Jewish movement, frankly, has even greater power? Because a state is small enough that pretty much people know each other. You know, at a state legislature, especially in the smaller states where we're organizing like Illinois or Ohio or Pennsylvania, they're not such a big playing field that most of the governor usually knows the prominent rabbis, the state legislature, each representative or senator knows their local rabbis and their local Reform leadership, but big enough that if you actually pass a law in a state, it can often have national consequences like health reform in Massachusetts or equal marriage in Massachusetts, both of which were campaigns I worked on when I was a congregational rabbi back in Boston. So when I went national about 8-10 years ago, we had this idea that we could leverage the power of the RAC, but do it on a more state and local level to both expand our base, as you said, but also extend our impact. And it's been incredibly successful. We now have 8 RAC state projects, and we're working on number 9. We are in California, Texas, New York, New Jersey, Florida, Pennsylvania, Illinois, Ohio, and we're also in a project this election cycle in Massachusetts as well. So, you know, again, these state projects, and by the way, that is about 60% of Reform Jews live in one of those states. Most of our congregations are. So that really does give us the capacity both to have political power, to actually move an agenda, but also to engage more of our people. And partly it's about building people power and engaging Jews in Jewish life, being living their values, by able to study Torah and worship together, but also to do justice together. And the last thing that I'll say is it's been remarkable. Even as things have been so stuck in Washington over these last 8 years, we've had remarkable wins in all of the states that I just mentioned. There have been wins locally on criminal justice reform, helping address the racial disparities in our criminal justice system. There have been significant wins on immigrant justice, protecting undocumented people on a state level. Lots of victories around economic justice, making sure that the poor and vulnerable have protections and safety net. Again, these are the kinds of things that can happen on a state level that one could only dream of in Washington.
There may be some people who are not familiar, perhaps aren't even affiliated with a synagogue, that want to get involved. If somebody wants to touch base with the RAC, they want to get involved, they want to write a check for perhaps, you know, $50,000, $100,000. You never know. Seriously, Jonah, how does somebody get in touch with you? What's the website? What's the contact information?
Great. Thank you for asking. We have a whole network of RACtivists, people who sign up to advocate for the things we work on, whether they consider themselves Reform Jews or belong to a synagogue or not. It's really simple, rac.org, rac.org. And I would say the number one thing most people are enrolling in right now is our civic engagement campaign, which is a nonpartisan attempt to preserve democracy. It's called Kol Kolot, which is Hebrew, because in Hebrew, the word kol, as you know, of course, but your listeners may not, the same word in Hebrew, kol, means voice and vote. So kol kolot is a kind of a play on words. Every voice, every vote. Because we know for a voice to be heard, a vote has to be counted. And we're enabling people to reach across lines of difference, to make sure that underrepresented communities, communities of color, low-income communities, people with disabilities, older people who see incredible barriers to voting, know how to vote, have their vote counted and protected. There are three main pillars to this campaign, and people can get involved in any one of the three pillars. One of them is 100% Jewish community voting, making sure that every Jew votes. Believe it or not, even though we do vote at higher totals in America than other groups, it isn't 100%. It's more like three quarters. So we want to make sure that every Jew in America lives out Jewish values through the preservation of democracy. It says in the Talmud that a community should not appoint a leader without being consulted. So we need to be consulted. The second pillar is reaching across lines of difference and partnering with the NAACP, the Poor People's Campaign, other local groups that are doing anti-voter suppression work and mobilizing to make sure that underrepresented communities have their votes counted. And the third and final pillar, and you and I talked about this earlier, is young people, young people, young people. We are involved in a network led by 16, 17, 18, 19, 20-year-olds to make sure that all those people who will be 18 by the time of the election know their rights, they know their polling place, they know how to do mail-in balloting, they know what the issues are, they know what Jewish values have to say, they make a choice, but that they make sure that they don't make the choice of apathy. They actually get, and by the way, after the Parkland shooting, we saw an enormous uptick of engagement by our young people. Many of the kids who were impacted in Parkland were actually part of the Reform Jewish family. So we have a whole network of leaders of young people who are using texting. They're using apps, the Empower app. How do you take your social network and every contact that you have, reach out to people in a personalized way and hold them accountable to exercise their obligation as Americans to vote?
Jonah, one of the things that it's on the menu for every single congregational rabbi, Jewish organizations, regardless of denominations, it's the rabbinic listservs are filled with this thing. And I know this is something that you're dealing with on a daily basis. That's the Black Lives Matter issue vis-a-vis the Black Lives Matter, capital B, capital L, capital M, the codicils that seem to be anti-Israel, pro-BDS, vis-a-vis small BLM, Black Lives Matter, and the constant push for social racial justice in the United States. It's a topic that comes up all the time. I know many colleagues are probably going to struggle with how to deal with it on the high holidays. How is Iraq dealing with this tension? It's a real tension.
I urge folks to visit the website and read a document that we wrote called Black Lives Matter is a Jewish Value. And it walks through in a very granular and compelling way the ways in which Jewish values call us to show up clearly and unequivocally for Black lives. That at this moment in American history and world history, there can be no other place to be other than squarely in the movement that says Black Lives Matter, to in the spirit, by the way, of the RAC, which was founded as a civil rights movement in the face of the intersectionality between anti-Semitism and racism. We as Jews, this is our call. I want to say a few other things. On the website, linked to the Black Lives Matter as a Jewish Value, are lots of useful resources. There is a post by Rabbi Josh Weinberg, the president of ARTSA, the Reform Movement Zionist arm, about why he is a Zionist, is a Black Lives Matter supporter and activist. There's a wonderful explication of what Black Lives Matter is and what it isn't, which I'll go into in a second to help people clarify. And most important, there's testimonials from Black Jews. It's very important that at this moment, we, as particularly in this podcast, as two kind of powerful white guys, this isn't about us right now. This is about Black and brown men and women who literally have their lives on the line every day, whether it's because they are in danger if they're pulled over by law enforcement, or they're in danger if they're going out for a jog, as Ahmed Arbery did in his own community in Atlanta, Georgia. It is dangerous to be Black or brown in America right now. And your listeners may not know, of the 7 million American Jews, nearly 1 million out of the 7 million describe themselves as not white. Now, that may be inclusive of Black Jews, brown Jews, Asian Jews, Jews of all hues. There are hundreds of thousands of Jews of color, and they are crying out to us, saying, why are you even debating the question of Black Lives Matter? Why aren't you showing up to protect and defend your own Jewish family, your Black and brown sisters and brothers whose lives are at risk and at stake? All of that said, particularly when we hear and listen first to Black and brown Jews, I understand why, because the 2015 platform that was written by a group called the Movement for Black Lives created a firestorm for us, where as part of a hundreds of pages long document, there was one paragraph that referenced Israel using the language of apartheid and genocide. Reprehensible, unfair, and a huge distraction. Several things to note. Number one, even when social movements, which are, you know, they've now called the Black Lives Matter movement, in the New York Times called it the largest social movement in American history. Millions of people are part of the Black Lives Matter movement. And so it isn't surprising that there are a small group of radicals who try and co-opt the movement for their own radical ends. Many of the people who helped author the platform for Black Lives didn't even know that that language was being included in it. This is one of the problems. You have, you know, in every social movement, you just have crazy voices. What we can't do is let them hijack the movement. We can't let ourselves be crowded out of this most important social movement. We can't let them hijack the movement. If we're not there, then we have no influence. And most important, we can't let us distract us from the core thing. The core thing is racism and racial justice in America and the world. That's what we have to focus on and not be distracted by. What we're hearing clearly from our Black and brown Jews and from Black and brown Americans is, why would you focus on Israel right now and Israel-Palestine issues when the real issue is the fact that George Floyd, for 8.5 minutes on national television, literally had the breath stolen from his body? And if he were unique or different, but think about it, Michael Brown, Freddie Gray, Tamir Rice, Sandra Bland, the list, Ahmed Arbery, Breonna Taylor, say their names again and again, because we really do face a crisis. And as hard as it is, we have to let the story be about us, particularly those of us who are white Jews who are Zionists and worried about Israel. We have to really focus on a matter at hand. By the way, I will also say, for the overwhelming majority of the civil rights leadership in our country, whether it's the NAACP or Reverend Barber of the Poor People's Campaign, for them, the Israel-Palestine issue is a sideshow. They know what's happening. They know it's an attempt by a shrill group to co-opt it. They also know that there are anti-Semites in the movement. There's no such thing as Black anti-Semitism any more than there is white anti-Semitism. There is anti-Semitism, and it's found wherever there are people. But what we can't do is let, you know, a few rotten apples destroy the incredible barrel of the bounty of racial justice that may be before us because we allow this moment to be stolen and co-opted by a bunch of anti-Semites.
And actually, you're talking about the Black Jewish movement. The end of this month, we do have a podcast coming up with a young woman, an African-American woman, who a millennial, you know, really who's working within the community and really talks literally from her perspective about some of the things that you're talking about that we never had to deal with growing up. It's something that, so I just as a plug for the a future Seekers of Meaning.
I'm thrilled that you're doing it. I don't know who the person is, but there is a huge body of work out there. And for people who are listening who are skeptical or surprised, take a look. Look at groups like B'chol Lashon, the Jewish Multiracial Network, the Jews of Color Field Building Initiative. It's incredible how much energy there is. And it skews young. It's mostly a millennial community. I'm active on Black Jewish Twitter. There are a lot of folks, and as Alana Kaufman, who runs the Jews of Color Field Building Initiative, likes to say, she's herself a Black Jewish woman. You may not have a lot of people right now that you know who are Black and Brown Jews, but just wait, your grandchildren are coming.
Well, as I tell congregations when I go out, and we did this thing, even when I'm running the Department of Jewish Family Concerns, when we did all the demographic analysis. Yes. I say, if you don't believe me to congregational boards, I say, just this Sunday, go take a walk through the hallways of your religious school. And if you really don't believe me, go up to Camp Harlem or Crane Lake or Osrui or some of the camps and look at the faces of the kids at our camps. It's not the same faces that it was when I was starting out. And in truth, that is really a glimpse into our future.
Because you were having those conversations even 10, 20 years ago, think about it now. That's 20 years of kids that have grown up in our movement that are looking at us saying, are you going to confront racism or not? And by the way, many of whom are experiencing racism at their synagogues and in their camps. So we have work to do.
Oh, no, there's a tremendous amount of work to do. But let me ask you something that's also been raised with me by colleagues and congregants as well, and private con, you know, you're sitting around having when we used to be able to sit around and have a cup of coffee after. And if you remember those days, the charge from, let's say, more conservative members of our community saying, you know, and actually Jack Wertheimer channeled this in his book on the changing nature of American Judaism last year. The social justice platform of the reform movement is nothing more than the Democratic Party's social justice platform, and that's what's wrong with it. How do we begin to respond to that? You may have heard that once or twice.
No, I have. I mean, I understand why, from an optics perspective, particularly for those who disagree with the outcomes of our process, why they land on that. And what I do is I don't respond to it. I let people know who may not how we get to where we get, that it starts with this 3,000-year-old tradition of which the prophets are quite at the center, although you don't even have to start with the prophets. As we talked just a second ago, that the transformation of our people from an enslaved people into a people of community and covenant is the core master story of our people. That is a social justice narrative. And by the way, it isn't just about freedom. It's about standing at Mount Sinai and saying, we commit, right? We commit to the poor, the widow, the stranger, the orphan. We commit to being a community that lives its values by caring for one another. If that isn't social justice, I don't know what is. And it has implications. It means you care about things like healthcare access for all people. It means you care about elder care. It means you care about people with disabilities. Where I think reasonable people can disagree is, what's the policy position that best lift up those values? And there are times, I think, when legitimately there are conservative people in our community who say, why do you always land on the, you know, what is seemingly the Democrat solution rather than the Republican solution? All I can say to that is that the reform movement goes through a very rigorous policy setting process. And you've lived it, Rabbi Edris, for years when you were on the URJ staff community. But I don't make this stuff up in Washington. What will happen is the Commission on Social Action, which is a representative body of nearly 200 leaders, rabbis, cantors, educators, synagogue presidents, young people through NIFTY, college students, women of Reformed Judaism, men of Reformed Judaism, and debate and discuss issues. They study Jewish values and Jewish texts. They bring in policy experts. And then they make proposals, and those proposals get drafted into resolutions, whether it's, you know, universal voting rights or universal healthcare or whatever the proposals are. Those resolutions get shared out with every congregation in our movement, which means, you know, 1.4 or 5 million people have the opportunity, if their rabbi and temple president shares the resolutions with them, to give feedback and weigh in. That feedback is actually now, you know, for the last 10 years, it's all been online, which gives us a real opportunity. We have Zoom calls, webinars, open fora. And then after a period of months for debate and for discussion, those resolutions go to the floor of the biennial convention. So for example, at our last convention in December, we made history becoming the first major Jewish denomination organization to pass a resolution calling for reparations. For those who are the descendants of 400 years of the legacy of slavery, Jim Crow, and mass incarceration, and the like. And that was not landed on lightly. It took a year of dialogue and debate in our synagogues about what reparations look like and what our responsibility as Jews, particularly Jews who have a relationship to the Holocaust and reparations that came out of the Holocaust, what would that look like? So it wasn't some left or right wing platform. It wasn't the Democrats or Republicans. It really did bubble up from our own movement and our enduring Jewish values. And, you know, so again, you can disagree with the outcomes, but one can't criticize the process for not having been inclusive, nonpartisan, rooted in Jewish values, and the like.
Thank you. The before we start running out of time, I do want to ask you just make sure that people know, because there's a couple of programs that the RAC runs, which are transformational to many people. So could you just talk to me very briefly about the Lit HaKain program and the sort of like gold star of the those programs, the consultation on conscience?
Excellent. Well, it's all different this year because of COVID. And so we're working hard on that. We've already changed Lit HaKain. Lit HaKain, and I will say this as a parenthetical side note, that generationally, I think you'll really appreciate Rabbi Edress and being a peer of sorts of Saperstein. When I was 14 years old, my youth rabbi, who is Barney Brickner, I hope you appreciate it.
Barney Brick was your rabbi?
He was an HUC student who was my youth advisor. He said, I have a friend in Washington who runs this center and he's thinking about bringing high school kids. Do you want to bring the youth group? So about 10 of us in 1984 went with Barney Brickner and I think Arnie Gluck was the other rabbi who went from New Jersey. And we spent 3 days studying Jewish texts with David Saperstein and Glenn Stein, studying policy issues. And then on Monday, we went up to Capitol Hill and we advocated. And I got into a fight with Senator Alphonse D'Amato about whether the Russians were evil. I mean, it was a whole interesting thing, but it was incredibly formative in my identity as a young Jew, that my Jewish values and the prophetic voice of Torah could actually matter in the world. Since that experiment in 1984, the RAC has brought more than 60,000 teenagers to Washington. They study Jewish values. They network with policy experts in Washington, and then they have this seminal experience where they literally go up to Capitol Hill. They speak directly to members of Congress, to senators, and to the staff of committees, and they make their positions and values known. And it has led to many rabbis. It's led to many advocates. It's a wonderful program. This year, it'll be all on Zoom, unfortunately. It's not safe right now to bring kids together on airplanes and stay in hotel rooms. But we will live through COVID. And then the consultation on conscience, every 2 years, we gather 1,500 people for as some kids, but mostly adults. And it's like a Lit HaKain seminar, but for adults. We're trying to figure out now what that will look like in the next couple of years, again, because of COVID and distancing. We've been doing a lot of our state advocacy work online. It's not hard to get state reps and state senators and governors on Zoom. So the consultation for the next little while may evolve into an online advocacy experience until we can be back in person in Washington soon.
Jonah, how do we restore the moral compass of this country?
Well, I think two things. One is, I think two things that are important. One is we have to listen more than we speak, and model the change that we want to be. We're so polarized and folks are so, so entrenched in their ways. We really have to make time. I try as a discipline to meet with and get to know as many people who disagree with me as I can, who I learn from and are challenged by, and to do it with sacredness and love. And we train our synagogues actually how to do that as well. We have a whole module of training around creating sacred dialogue. So that's, I think, one thing. There will be life after this administration. There'll be life after this pandemic. Kids that, please God, won't be separated from their parents. You know, the prisons won't be a source of mass incarceration. We can push through those things, but that won't be the end of the work. The work will be when we can restore civility and sanctity in our polity. And then the other thing with urgency, democracy, democracy, democracy. I don't care who people vote for. That's a private matter, but our democracy is on the line and we have to make sure that our institutions of democracy hold firm. That means people have to vote. It means people have to organize their friends and family and social networks also to vote, but it also means going the extra mile and making sure that the votes are counted, that votes are not suppressed. It means that the press is protected and the role of the free press. It means that mediating institutions, nonprofit organizations are invested and protected. This is all the civic framework of democracy, and it's all of our work to make sure that democracy is strong and survives this moment in time.
We're also living, Jonah, right now into the transition of generations, and I really want to end this conversation. And again, thank you very, very much. And again, the website is RAC.org to connect with this wealth of programming. We just witnessed the death of John Lewis, this generation of my youth, that got us involved when I was in college and at HUC in marching and demonstrating and volunteering, et cetera, et cetera. They're now leaving the stage. You are on the front lines of this. Where's the next generation of great civil rights leaders coming from? Where are they?
Well, I'm proud to say some of them from our camps and congregations and youth movement. You know, if you look at some of the leadership of the March for Our Lives, which was the student and teen-led protest movement after the Parkland shooting, many of them were our kids. When you look at the Green New Deal and the Sunrise movement, many of them are our kids. When you look at the Black Lives Matter movement, and I urge people, when I say the Black Lives Matter movement, I mean this radical because it's so inclusive, it's multiracial, it's interfaith. So it's radical in the sense that it really paints a picture of what America could look like. A lot of the leadership, a lot of the kids in the middle of it are our kids. And I think we should be proud of that. And we should take responsibility for that. I think as you look at people running for office, I think if you look at the LGBTQ equality movement, if you look at the kind of new intersectional women's movement, a lot of them are our kids. And it gets hard sometimes because some of the things that they say or the positions they take feel radical in a way that is uncomfortable as opposed to radical in a good way, transformative radical. But I would urge people to picture every one of our radical young people as your own granddaughter or grandson and think about how proud you could be and how much you have to learn.
And also perhaps reflect upon when we were their age and having those same conversations with our parents and grandparents. And there's still lots of work to do. Rabbi Jonah Pesner, Religious Action Center. Thank you, Jonah. Thank you very, very much. I really appreciate this. Continued good luck, success. Most of all, health and joy and peace with your family. Take care. I'm sure we'll be seeing each other either on Zoom or online and hopefully in person. Just stay safe and stay healthy. And thank you for all the work. And thank you for the RAC. Take care. To all of you, thank you again for listening to this edition of Secrets of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. And a reminder, you can follow us on the website, jewishsacredaging.com, the Facebook page, Jewish Sacred Aging on Facebook. And again, if you'd like to make a tax-free donation to help further the work of the website and on these podcasts, please go to the website and click on the donate icon. If you have suggestions or comments on the programs, please send them to me, rabbiaddress@jewishsacredaging.com. These podcasts are recorded at the studios of Lubetkin Global Media in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, and produced by our wonderful producer, Steve Lubetkin. Again, thank you for being with us. We look forward to greeting you on the next Secrets of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. Toda and Shalom.